KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. Again, my guest was last with us for a film that I liked quite a bit, People Like Us. His newest project is an adaptation of the Walter Tevis novel, which will be 60 years old next year. And it's sort of a continuation of the Nicholas Sprogue 1976 film. Of course, we're talking about The Man Who Fell to Earth. And my guest is Alex Kurtzman. Alex, welcome back. Thank you for doing the show.
Oh, thanks, Elvis. It's so great to be here. It's always great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. And there's an opening line that could be an opening line from almost anything you've done. It could be Lock and Key or Sleepy Hollow or this. How did we get here?
Yeah. So that opening line came, honestly, because when the project came to us, Jenny Lumet and I, she's my writing partner, you know, I was very nervous about taking the job. Sarah Timberman brought it to us through Hulu. And Sarah Timberman is our one of our fellow executive producers. And I was very skeptical, both because to stand in the shadow of Nicholas Rogue, Walter Tevis, and obviously David Bowie was just such a daunting prospect. And I think that really what we were trying to figure out was we were looking around at the world and I think able to make less and less sense of what we were seeing day to day. And what better way to work through the questions that we had than to use this story about the ultimate outsider who comes to do kind of a deep dive into what it means to be a human being with all of our, you know, foibles, but all of our beauty. And that's really the question we were asking ourselves when we started. How did we get here to this particular moment in time where we seem so utterly divided, where, you know, we've never been more connected, yet never further apart? And what is it about human beings that have endured over time and that will hopefully continue to endure? And, you know, the novel and the film are beautiful but bleak. And I think we felt that we needed to make a show that honored the spirit of both of those objects, but also reminded audiences of why people are wonderful and why there is hope for us.
It's funny because I found myself thinking, we were talking about getting this a little bit before we got started, but more so in the Nicholas Rogue film, and you continue that theme here, the idea of being corrupted by touch and contact.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rogue's film, I'm a huge fan of his films. And in some ways, I think The Man Who Fell to Earth is his most nonlinear. The first Nicholas Rogue film I ever saw was Bad Timing, which actually really blew me away because I think it was the first time that I understood you could tell a story not in order. But there's something, it's almost as if in the film, he cut out all the sections where the narrative was going to connect and you would get the explanation for why something was happening. It's very elliptical. And the movie really asks you to fill in a lot of gaps. That was daunting, but also I think that the film, to me, the thing I take from it most is that he and his cinematographer, Anthony Richmond, managed to convey this extraordinary loneliness and isolation. You know, you'd have Bowie, this small character, in these massive, massive spaces and these beautiful anamorphic frames. And I think in some ways, to your question about touch and physical contact, there's something about the lack of it in that film that somehow, enhances the concept of what it means to be connected to human beings and what it means to be alone and how lonely we can be as a species.
I've got to ask you, for people who don't know, and a lot of people might not know The Man Who Fell to Earth because it is what's now called a cult film, but it's a film that is, as you're alluding to here, more resonant now than ever before. If you can let audiences know what the show's about.
This story is about an alien who comes to Earth, who is the second alien. The original alien was played by David Bowie in the film The Man Who Fell to Earth. And in our story, we pick up 45 years later, and Chiwetel Ejiofor plays a character named Faraday, who arrives to finish the mission that Thomas Newton, David Bowie's character, started 45 years ago. And in the original story, he was sent here to bring water back to his planet, succumbed to human vices, became an alcoholic, and was blinded and sort of ended his journey having failed. And so our story, as I said, picks up 45 years later when a new character comes to finish Newton's mission. And obviously the question is, will all the same things that happened to Newton now happen to Faraday?
I hadn't thought about it until I reread the book, but there is so much of what Tevis does as a novelist, which is almost about this kind of Old Testament sense of corruption, how easily the flesh is corrupted. And that's something that very much runs through Nicholas Rogue as well. The idea of an innocent who, as soon as they make contact with others, how that ruination. And because there are no villains in those pieces, then really no villains in The Hustler, the villain really is hunger and greed, and it becomes that kind of thing too. And I just wonder if that was something, because you internalize it so well in this adaptation, if that was something you guys were playing with, you and Jenny were thinking about as you were doing the adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're our own worst enemy is really the moral of the story in Tevis's novel, and certainly in the Rogue film. And the thing that was interesting was, at first, you know, even though Jenny was so, she saw it before I saw it. She just saw what it could be. And I think I was just nervous about stepping into the shadows of all these giants. And I knew on some level that, well, at least if you go to the source material, the CIA tried to stop him. So there's a story there. We just have to figure out how to tell it in a way that doesn't feel like a cliche. Because, you know, how many aliens come to Earth and then the government tries to stop them, stories can exist on the planet. You know, there's just been already so many. And so we just wanted to figure out a way to do it in a totally different way.
Again, you're talking about Rogue and not just The Man Who Fell to Earth, but also bad timing. Just how the idea of need being the precipitant of a downfall.
Yeah, need and obsession. I mean, bad timing, you know, is about this kind of need and what happens when two characters sort of end up toying with each other and sort of ruining each other. You know, Tevis was clearly dealing with his own demons and did what I think all great artists do, which is he exercised them through his art. But he was obviously struggling with addiction issues himself when he wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth. So the whole thing is I don't know if the word is metaphor or allegory. I can't really tell in that particular case. But I think he wrote it so authentically and so honestly because he was writing from such deep experience. And that was something that we really did want to capture, but in a different way, just to put our own spin on it.
I guess there's another thing, and what connects this, I think, for me is to people like us, is how need becomes is such a big part of that, too. And he thinks that he's above that until he steps into it, and then it ruins his life as well.
I never really thought about the connection between those two things. And the thing that's always so compelling about a character who is driven by need is that it suggests that they are not actually facing something significant in their lives. They're barreling along and sort of not making choices. They're making all the wrong choices. And that's the most fertile ground to start a character from, because inevitably life is going to come and kick them and make them realize that everything they've been doing is wrong. And so for Faraday, the character in The Man Who Fell to Earth, he's only believed that he could live as a drone on his planet, which is to say that he's only supposed to follow orders. He's never supposed to give them. He's not supposed to have any autonomy or authority or personality really in any way. And what he comes to learn is that the only way that he will complete the mission he's been sent here to do is if he figures out a way to step out of that role and start thinking like someone who gives orders. And in order to do that, he has to become a human being. He doesn't have an innate sense of what it means to connect with people like that, or to make singular choices, or to have things, to face the kinds of choices we have to make every day. And that hopefully that journey is going to be a satisfying one for people.
It's The Treatment. My extremely patient guest is Alex Kurtzman, whose new project for Showtime is an adaptation of The Man Who Fell to Earth. I guess I just find it so interesting, too, because it's also, and this really, for me, connects to a lot of the stuff you've done, is about characters' needs to communicate. And we get to watch Faraday's kind of shaped by this environment and how that need to communicate, another need, in fact, is sort of refined, but this still doesn't take away from the fact that there's corruption there. But talk about him learning to be part of this thing we have here on this planet.
You know, Chiwetel is one of the greatest actors I've ever worked with. And we became very, very close. And like so many actors who have the kind of experience that he has, he always starts from the right question. And when we sat down to start breaking the text down, which we did every day together, all day, even on days when we weren't shooting, we would meet for a couple hours and we'd go through the work ahead. He said that in order for me to understand how to move on this planet, I have to understand how I moved on mine, because it's going to inform everything that I do. And he was, of course, right. Gravity is different on his planet. So the way he would feel the weight of gravity here would be entirely different. And one of the things that emerged in that conversation is the idea that the Antheans don't communicate verbally. They communicate through their version of sign language. And part of why they developed that, and this really came from Chiwetel, is that the planet was so uninhabitable and inhospitable to them, and the winds and, you know, all of the noise of the planet just got so great that they could no longer literally hear each other. So they had to develop signs to communicate, you know, in the middle of sandstorms. One of the things that we talked about early on that Jenny and I built into the script is the idea that he comes as like this extraordinary mimic. He can parrot everything he sees. And you see that in the first couple scenes. When the police come to arrest him, he's literally mirroring them. He doesn't even understand what he's doing. And obviously that gets him in a lot of trouble. And then when he ends up in the police station, he learns to process language in less than a minute by listening to every single conversation around him. And he has very acute hearing and a different kind of sensory perception as an alien. So he's able to learn English in less than a minute. And he begins to communicate in English, but there's a difference between being able to repeat and maybe answer basic questions and then being able to answer them with a sense of autonomy and authority and a sense of self. And so one of the things that we worked on in great minutia, scene to scene, the way his ability to communicate opens up. So it starts very stilted. His mouth is moving too much. It's as if he doesn't quite understand how to hold the words in his mouth. And then by the time he meets Justin, he's learning a little bit more and she teaches him more. And by the end of the pilot, he's actually just starting to communicate a sense of emotion that he probably has never really been able to articulate before, even to himself on his own planet.
We should say, too, here, Justin's played by Naomi Harris. I think what's interesting about that, too, is that we find through this that as he speaks to people, we realize that people aren't used to being heard in that way. They're not used to being really listened to. And so that changes sort of the tenor of every contact he has with somebody new that he meets.
It's so true. I mean, he's listening more deeply than most human beings ever listen to each other. And he makes the observation in the pilot that we think we're communicating with each other, but we're not. We exist mostly within ourselves. And that's a really interesting first observation for an outsider who comes to look at how we are. And, you know, again, it goes back to this idea that we've never been more connected as a species, yet we've never been further apart.
That also kind of runs through as well. You've so often, that's why I said that line really kind of resonated for me, because I was thinking about Lock and Key or in Sleepy Hollow, or even to some extent in Clarice, about these people who have to ask how we got here. And they're all people, so many of your protagonists are people who pay attention and sort of take in clues and take in information in a way that completely discomforts the people they're communicating with.
I mean, that's why I love talking to you. I never really thought of it that way. And I guess I'm a pretty shy person in general. And I certainly, as a kid, I think I was much more comfortable observing than really sort of diving in into conversations. Even now, it's interesting. And I think that it affords you a certain perspective, which is that you pay very close attention to what is going on between the lines, not just what people are saying, but what they're not saying or what their body language is saying. And I think in that sense, it was, I guess, very easy for me to step into the point of view of an alien, because I kind of often feel like one.
Well, it's funny because I just find myself thinking in so many instances, like when he's talking to Clark Peters, who plays Naomi's father, and just sort of the pleasure that Josiah takes in speaking to somebody who's actually listening to what he's saying.
Yes, and seeing him at the deepest level, which is that Faraday articulates for Josiah, played by Clark, who is just also a miracle of a human being. He's saying all these things that, like, we as human beings don't ever want to say about the elderly or the way that the elderly may feel about themselves. And yet he's articulating these extraordinary truths that are both very painful and very beautiful. And for the first time, Josiah begins to feel heard, just like Justin for the first time begins to feel heard. And you have this family that's been so invisible for so long, who suddenly is seen by this outsider and who enables them to be seen by the world, which I think is part of what makes the show satisfying.
We will take a break. My guest, who again is being incredibly patient, is Alex Kurtzman. His newest project is an adaptation and revisiting the material of The Man Who Fell to Earth. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're communicating with my guest, Alex Kurtzman, whose newest project as adapter is a continuation, I think, of The Man Who Fell to Earth, both the novel and the film by Nicholas Roeg. But I find myself thinking, too, about that line, I had to be reborn, because so much of what you do as, I think, one of the premier adapters of IP that we as audiences have relationships to, is you have to do that with it. You have to sort of take a look at it and say, what is it that demands that I put my hands on it? You were talking in the first half about your trepidation about stepping into this. So often you've taken on pieces of material that people know and love and feel like they have not only a relationship with, but a proprietary relationship to. Are you visited by that same kind of anxiety as you step into these projects that people do have relationships with?
Yeah, for sure. I think if you don't enter into the work with some sense of fear, you're missing something. And it's also part of why Jenny and I make such good partners, because we have different fears at different times and different excitements at different times. And I think if it hadn't been for Jenny, I'm not sure that I would have said yes to this particular piece of material. I think she just intuitively felt something there before either of us really even knew what it was. You know, when you take on these things, be it Star Trek or The Man Who Fell to Earth, or people have such different levels of connection to them. What you have to recognize just going through the door of that experience is that you are messing with people's childhoods. Some of their most formative moments as people, they would attribute to the, you know, watching Star Trek and feeling heard or seen for the first time. Or even with a movie like Man Who Fell to Earth, it's certainly more of a cult film. I think people really felt it as a particular thing, as a moment in time in the 70s. And the endurance of Bowie's performance in that film has been very meaningful to people. You're never going to please everybody. There's no way to do that. And if you try, in my experience, you always end up with something that's just going right down the middle. And frankly, it doesn't work. You have to take a big swing with these kinds of things, because it's the only way for it to evolve. It's the only way. Nothing will evolve unless you take a big swing. You don't want to just regurgitate or repeat what people have been doing. You want to say, what you did was incredible. And now, obviously, in the case of Man Who Fell to Earth, here we are 45 years later, and all three artists who made both the film and the novel were writing about something that's still so relevant. But what's different now? What is it about this particular generation or this particular moment in our timeline that's different?
The Bowie performance is he's almost a mime. I mean, he's kind of dancing in place. Chiwetel's physicality is much more, I would say, earthbound, but there's power there. And I was thinking about that as you were talking about the way he communicates, and he's not even aware of the size of his voice, or I think aware of the size of his physicality. And just, I mean, I thought about that great moment where he's in the pilot, where he's being tasered, and he looks and sees himself with these electrodes on his face.
Yeah,
and just all this dawning awareness. But you're playing with something by casting an actor who is, in his way, quite steely and powerful and concentrated. What were you looking for from him? Because you, strictly speaking, not taking that character, you revisit that later with Bill Nye as Newton, the Bowie character. But what was it you wanted from him?
I mean, it starts with the fact that when Chiwetel Ejiofor or Naomi Harris or Bill Nye or any of the actors say yes to your script, you get down on your knees and you thank God, because they're going to give you the biggest gifts ever. And, you know, having seen Chiwetel in so many things, it's funny because I had rewatched 12 Years a Slave a little while before we started casting. And what he does in that film physically, I couldn't even imagine how he put himself through it. I knew that no matter what we did, I was going to be in the hands of somebody who was just almost supernaturally gifted. It's so interesting because his process is very intellectual, as is mine. Like, we really love to talk and get into the details and the lines and what's between the lines and how do we manifest all these things. One thing to write it, it's another thing entirely to put it in front of the camera and make it feel real. With actors like this, you go in front of the camera knowing they will do most of the job for you, and that your job sometimes is just to stand back and sometimes it's just to make micro adjustments to them. But you have to create from the beginning a place of extraordinary trust. And right from the beginning with all the actors, we had extraordinary trust in each other, and that just built and built and built over the course of the season.
It's a treat. We're talking to Alex Kurtzman, I think one of the premier adapters of our time, whose newest project for Showtime is the updating and revisiting of the material, The Man Who Fell to Earth, from the Walter Tevis novel, and of course, the film by Nicholas Roeg. I just find myself thinking about what it's like, and this is the obvious thing, but I've got to bring it up, to have this material about a character who is the other, embodied by people of color. I mean, because that just brings, especially where we are now, context, not even subtextual, but brings context that makes us even more vivid, I think, than the idea of seeing. And it was David Bowie consciously made himself the other in whatever arena he was in, but still he's a white man. And to sort of see that free song between Bill Nye and Chiwetel Ejiofor in a scene where they're encountering each other. And I don't want to give too much away, but talk about that, because that's obviously something that you and Jenny Lumet must have discussed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jenny and I knew from the beginning that Justin was going to be a woman of color and that we wanted to write a story about her family. You know, and the truth is, Jenny really deserves all the credit for that, because I would never have been able to write that with any authenticity. And I think that's another testament, I think, to our partnership, is how much trust we have with each other. And once we get into the zone of it together, we really do start seeing it in exactly the same way. It would have been utterly inauthentic for me to take that on. And it, same as the director of the show, I felt like part of why I ended up choosing Tommy Maddox, who, it, you know, like I said, has become my person now. We were so connected. When you have a cinematographer, you're not just sharing eyes. This is going to sound super cheesy, Elvis. I apologize in advance. You're sharing a soul. Because when it comes down to those little micro moments between characters, where you place the camera and how the cinematographer is lighting it is the difference between it being really real or not. And as the white director of a story about a black family, I knew that the DP couldn't be a Caucasian. It would be wrong. And I had to trust my team to tell me when I was not seeing something correctly and vice versa. And that became an extraordinary place for all of us to work from. In terms of Justin's character, Jenny and I from the beginning knew that, you know, if you asked Jenny, she would say women of color are the most imperiled species on the planet in many ways, and that affords them a very particular perspective. Because if you were an alien and you were coming to the planet and you wanted to find out what was really going on, you'd go there because you would get the truth. And that was our operating assumption. And then the character of Faraday, in a funny way, when we were writing it, because Faraday was an alien, we were not thinking necessarily, I think we were always hoping that we would end up cast somebody of color in that part. But we were writing the alien side first. And then obviously the choice to cast Chiwetel in that role made, you know, for example, the scene where he first encounters the police and gets tased, that's an entirely different scene because of the color of his skin. And we knew that. We knew that, and we wrote to it, and we wrote it deliberately, and we wanted to make a statement about it. And, you know, welcome to Earth. You're 2 minutes in and this is what happens. The show hopefully comes from the perspective of recognizing that these people who had been rendered invisible for so long are actually the most important people on the planet and are going to save us.
So talking about this, the Bowie, I guess, of all this, I find myself thinking, as Faraday has a line early on in that opening speech he gives, he talks about Lazarus, and I find myself thinking about the Bowie album Lazarus and how that was probably in some way triggered by, in his way, his sequel to The Man Who Fell to Earth, and wondered how conscious an echo that was.
Extremely conscious. And also, if you listen very closely to the music that Jeff Roos and I had the great benefit of getting to write the score over the course of a year because of the pandemic, it slowed everything down. And if you're going to write music, the question inevitably comes up, like, do you make allusion to Bowie at all? And it's a super, super, super slippery slope, because there is one and only one, and there will only be one David Bowie. And so what you don't want to do is make the wrong kind or the lame kind. But if you listen very carefully to what the electric guitar is doing in the opening cue, it's a slowed down version of Lazarus.
Okay, so I wasn't hearing things. No, I was wondering about that because I couldn't hear that, and then have him say Lazarus and go, "Oh, is that what this is going on here?" Because it's clear that. But also, and I want to talk to you too about how interesting the music bed is for this. Not only do you have that and that literal echo, or it's just a figurative echo, but also the kind of music choices, like having an ukulele cover of Claire de Lune or Sharon Jones doing This Land Is My Land, just about these things that we think we know, having them reinterpreted by people who aren't part of the mainstream, and how that echoes your casting choices.
The pandemic afforded me a lot of time to think and write because everything stopped, right? The freight train of production stopped. And so this show was supposed to happen, and I think we were 5 scripts in, and then everything stopped. And then it was a year plus later before we started shooting. And in that period of time, from when the pandemic started, I created a playlist that I think is over 20 hours long. I wake up with a song in my head every day, and I don't get to choose it. It just appears in my head. And it will take me down a road, and Spotify will open me up to a link for another piece of music like it. And I just would acquire these pieces of music as we went that were inspiring me on the day. Much of it ended up on the show. Some of it didn't end up on the show, but it just inspired me in my writing that day. And, you know, the 70s wasn't really my era of music, but for some reason, all the music choices for me intuitively went back to the 70s, some to the 60s, but mostly the 70s. And as you say, were all non-mainstream pieces of music written by mostly people of color who were kind of making comments. This Land Is Your Land is obviously a commentary. And that was really an amazing experience for me to be able to live in that space. And I've now emerged with this, you know, literally 20-hour playlist that marks just like every turn of the last 2 years of writing and of pandemic life and of making this film in a pandemic. But yeah, it was a deep, deep dive. And I think had I not had those 2 years, I don't know that the music choices would have been as varied and deep as they are.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for doing this for the time. You're always welcome here. Come back whenever you got a new project, please. Thank you for doing it.
Thanks, Elvis. So great talking to you always.
My pleasure. My guest is Alex Kurtzman, whose new project is The Man Who Fell to Earth for Showtime. Our production staff includes the equally patient Katie Gilchrist. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.